From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is the award-winning Washington Bureau Chief of USA Today, Susan Page. She's the author of the recently published book, The Matriarch, Barbara Bush and the Making of an American Dynasty. It's a biography of former First Lady Barbara Bush, wife of President George H.W. Bush, and mother of President George W. Bush. A veteran political journalist, Susan Page has covered 6 White House administrations and 10 presidential elections. She interviewed the past 9 presidents from Richard Nixon through Donald Trump and reported from 6 continents and dozens of foreign countries. Susan bases her biography of Barbara Bush on more than 100 interviews with Bush family members, friends, and hours of conversations with Mrs. Bush herself in the final 6 months of her life. She also had access to decades of Mrs. Bush's personal diaries. The Matriarch examines not only Bush's public persona, but also less well-known aspects of her extraordinary life. Barbara Pierce Bush was a descendant of the Pilgrims who came to the New World in 1620 on the English ship the Mayflower. She was also related to Franklin Pierce, the 14th President of the United States. Despite her distinguished lineage, Barbara dealt with much hardship throughout her life. Her mother would often criticize her for being overweight, which left lifelong scars on her self-esteem. As a young wife, Barbara lost her 3-year-old daughter Robin to leukemia. And in middle age, she struggled with depression that was so serious that she contemplated suicide. According to Susan Page, Barbara Bush was only the 2nd woman in history to be both the wife and mother of presidents, and the only woman to live to see both her husband and a son in that high office. Throughout her life, Barbara Bush was consistently underestimated by her mother, by her teachers, by her husband, and by herself. Nonetheless, Susan Page tells us that the traditional homemaker and mother went on to become a formidable political campaign strategist and beloved First Lady. To talk more about her biography of Barbara Bush and other current political issues, Susan Page joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
I'm so glad to be here, Carol.
And always, I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, Jim Malone.
Nice to see you.
Well, Susan, first of all, congratulations on this very moving and informative biography. Of course, it came out earlier this year in April. It would have marked the first anniversary of the death of Barbara Bush. And reading it for me was like getting to know this public figure in a very intimate way. Barbara Bush was fascinating in that, as we know, she was both First Lady and the mother of a subsequent president, George W. Bush. And you said in the book that she was the most underestimated First Lady of modern times. Did you sense that before you embarked on the project? What actually drew you to Barbara Bush?
You know, I had covered Barbara Bush as the spouse of candidates, as the spouse of George H.W. Bush. He was, in fact, the first presidential candidate I ever interviewed. That was in 1980. And as, of course, the mother of George W. Bush. Those are all campaigns that I covered as a reporter. And I knew that she was interesting. She was caustic. She was funny. She was outspoken. But it was not until I did research for this book that I understood how influential she also had been.
You said she became an indispensable advisor to George Bush, something that we wouldn't know, you know, from just watching her on the public stage.
And, you know, she didn't start out that way. When they were first married right after World War II, they had a very traditional marriage where he called the shots. He had just graduated from Yale University in Connecticut, and he came home one day and told her that they were going to move to Texas for him to take a job. Now, he didn't ask her if they should move to Texas. He didn't ask her what she would think about a move to Texas. He just made that decision, and she went along with it in the most traditional arrangements between spouses in those days. But over time, she became increasingly confident herself. He became increasingly reliant on her judgment about things. And by the time he was running for president, hers was the voice that in some ways he listened to most. And there were some occasions in 1988 where he ran for president and won the presidency that she was the critical voice on how to proceed with that campaign.
Let me let my colleague Jim in for a question.
What kind of advice was she adept at for President Bush, her husband? And then, you know, would it be a different sort of type of advice for her son, who is also a president?
It's interesting. One of the things she did in the 1988 campaign for her husband was she urged him to be tougher. He was reluctant to do some negative TV ads against his opponents in that campaign, against Bob Dole, who was another Republican running for the nomination, and later against Michael Dukakis, who was the Democratic nominee running against George H.W. Bush in 1988. And she urged him to air tougher ads, to make tougher statements. That turned out to be crucial in his victory, both in getting the Republican nomination for president and in winning the White House. And her role with her son was different. She was very supportive of her son, naturally. You'd expect that of any mother. But she was also willing to raise issues with him when she thought he was wrong. And that was different from her husband. George H.W. Bush had said, when George W. Bush was inaugurated as president, that he wasn't going to give his son advice unless his son asked for it. And his son almost never asked for his advice. But Barbara Bush did not make that kind of promise. And in fact, she felt free to go in and talk to her son when she thought he was doing the right thing and doing the wrong thing. And on one notable example, she had real concerns about the course of the Iraq war. She went to her son, said he was listening too much to Vice President Cheney, to the Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, that he should be listening to other more moderate voices. So much so that he finally said that she needed to stop it, that he was the president, that he knew what he was doing, and that she had to trust him.
Did she have, do you think, a good sense on, say, public opinion or where the country was on certain things, and she could bring that to bear on some of this advice?
She had a sense of people. You know, she was a woman of great privilege. She had fantastic social bloodlines. The Bushes, she married into a wealthy family, the Bushes. But she had a sense of how people live their lives and what was important to them. And I think one thing that helped her do that was she had this tragic experience with her daughter. When Barbara Bush was just 28 years old and a young mother in Midland, Texas, her daughter was diagnosed with leukemia, a disease she had never heard of. 6 months later, after six brutal months of treatment, Robin died. And it was that experience, I think, when Barbara Bush and George Bush discovered that all their money and their position and their power could do nothing to save Robin. They got to know parents of much less fortunate circumstances in the same boat with children with leukemia. And I think that was an experience that really left a mark on Barbara Bush.
I'd like to pick up on that point, Susan, because as you said, the death of Robin influenced her deeply as well as George Bush. One thing you associated with her death was that Barbara Bush's views vis-a-vis abortion evolved. Perhaps that experience informed them. Could you talk about that?
Barbara Bush gave me this extraordinary gift. It was really the last time we talked, although we didn't know it was the last time we were going to talk. I was supposed to have a sixth interview with her. She became ill and hospitalized before that could happen. At the end of the fifth interview, she told me I could read her diaries, which she had said at the first interview not to even ask about because I was never going to see her diaries, which I understood because your diaries are a very personal thing. So she gave me this permission to go and look at these decades and decades of diaries. And I was going through her diary from 1980. This is when George Bush, her husband, made his first bid for the presidency. He didn't get the nomination. He did become vice president for President Reagan that year. And in her diary was tucked a four-page letter she had written to herself. At the top of this letter, it said, "Thoughts about abortion," because she knew with her husband running for president, she was going to be asked about that difficult and controversial issue. And she wanted to think about what she believed. And in this letter, she said that, "I was there when Robin was born, and I felt her soul enter her body. And I was there with Robin the instant she died, and I felt her soul leave her body." And if your soul enters your body at the moment of your birth, then abortion isn't murder, and it ought to be left up to a mother and her doctor. And that was the view she held for the rest of her life.
I wonder how she was seen by others in the family, because her legend seemed to grow over the decades. And of course, you know, with two presidents in the family, in some sense, you can look at the Bush family as a counterpart to the Kennedys on the Republican side. But, you know, sometimes you would hear her sons, whether it's George W. Bush, the former president, or Jeb Bush, former governor of Florida, or others, and they almost talk a little bit of fear and trepidation about her. But she had seemed to have an outsized influence within the family.
You know, Jim, when I covered these campaigns that involved Barbara Bush, voters would think of her as this very sweet grandmotherly figure because she had this cloud of gray hair and she always wore pearls. And people would often say, you know, you're just like my grandmother, or she's so sweet, she must bake wonderful cookies. This was not at all who Barbara Bush was. And people in her family understood that. Now, while she looked very grandmotherly, and while she was, in fact, a grandmother who loved her grandchildren, loved her children, she was tough. And her nickname within the family was the Enforcer, because the fact is, she enforced the rules. She ruled on what's what. She sometimes hurt people's feelings. She could be not reserved about saying what she thought. And sometimes, even for members of her family, that would leave a little bit of a sting. I can tell you, you always knew where you stood with Barbara Bush.
And it seems like her sons were always aware of that, and they would comment about it, often in jest in a way, but often there's an element of truth when people try to make light of a situation like that, and just her influence on their lives seemed quite large.
Well, here's an example. When her son Jeb Bush was running for president in 2016 for the Republican nomination, we knew he was thinking about it. We didn't think he had decided. She went and did an interview on the Today Show where she said he shouldn't run, that the country had had enough Bushes. There were other people than the Bushes and the Clintons who ought to run. And the fact is, Jeb Bush had at that point already decided he was going to run. He just hadn't announced it. He watches this interview on TV, appalled. Here his mother, a national icon, is saying he shouldn't run. So he called her and said, what are you doing? Why did you do that? And she said, they asked me a question and I answered it. And, you know, if you look at the perspective of some hindsight, as it turned out in 2016, Americans maybe had enough Bushes and enough Clintons and were ready for somebody new.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is USA Today Bureau Chief Susan Page. She's also the author of the recently published book, The Matriarch, Barbara Bush and the Making of an American Dynasty. I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA Senior National Correspondent Jim Malone. This is a reminder that our Peace USA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. And a new VOA English app for both Android and Apple devices has been developed, and we encourage you to download and use them. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal fan from Ghana, Kwasi Oteng. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our guest, Susan Page. And Susan, you know, speaking of frankness with regard to Barbara Bush, there's one thing I'll never forget, and that is the way she referred to Geraldine Ferraro, the vice presidential candidate of Walter Mondale, who ran against Ronald Reagan, right, in 1984, when she referred to Ms. Ferraro as that name that rhymes with witch. That is the...
Rhymes with rich. And the reason it's important is because, of course, everyone thought of a certain word when she said that. And when she tried to recover, when she was apologizing, she said the word she meant was witch. Although that was, in fact, not the word she had in mind. You know, this is a story with kind of a press side to it. She had made that comment to two reporters who were on Air Force Two, who were covering the campaign, a reporter for the Associated Press and a reporter for United Press International. And she came back and made this quip, which was delicious. And she then left. And the two reporters, I interviewed both of them for the book, had a debate about whether it was on or off the record. Because typically, in a situation like that, things that are said on the plane are off the record. And the UPI reporter said, we can't have the wife of the vice president, the second lady, refer to the wife of his opponent for president by a word like that and not report it. And then if the UPI reporter was going to report it, the AP reporter said he was going to report it too. So they did. And one thing that was interesting about Mrs. Bush, I thought, she told me that she had thought her comment was off the record, but she made no complaints about it. She understood that she had said it, that the furor that followed was not the fault of the reporters who reported it. It was her responsibility.
Another little juicy detail that you write about, something that we wouldn't know about, perhaps. You wrote a lot about the tensions between Barbara Bush. She was the wife of Vice President George Bush.
And then, of course, First Lady Nancy Reagan and Ronald Reagan. What was the story behind that contentious relationship? To what do you attribute the friction?
So friction doesn't really convey the full meaning of their relationship. I covered the Reagan White House working then for Newsday newspaper in New York. And we knew that Barbara Bush and Nancy Reagan were not great friends. But we did not realize that they were, in fact, mortal enemies. And there was years and years of slights and offenses behind the two of them. Here's just one example. You know, one of the biggest social events of the Reagan White House was the dinner for Princess Diana and Prince Charles. It was a very hotly sought-after ticket. And the proposed guest list for this dinner went from the social secretary to Mrs. Reagan. She was the first lady. She got to decide who went to these dinners. And the memo from the social secretary had guests for this dinner: President and Mrs. Reagan on the first line, Vice President and Mrs. Bush on the second line, and then other ideas. Nancy Reagan picked up her pen and marked out the Bush's name. And later, Michael Deaver, who was the deputy White House chief of staff for her husband and the person who was kind of kept in charge of Nancy, the person who dealt with Nancy Reagan, called her and said, "Nancy, you can't not invite the vice president." And Nancy Reagan said, "Just watch me." And the night of the dinner, the Bushes were not invited.
That's really extraordinary. I don't even know how she got away with that, Nancy Reagan.
Yes, and Nancy Reagan had grievances of her own against Barbara Bush. You know, in some ways, they were so much alike. They were just a couple years apart in age. They both had gone to Smith College. They both had married men they adored. They were both important political advisors to their husbands. But they did not get along. They had different styles. They had different priorities. And the friction, as I said, friction
is an understatement.
Friction on steroids.
Did that in any way affect the relationship between Vice President Bush and President Reagan?
You know, I don't think so. And Nancy Reagan also didn't get along very well with George Bush. They had some disputes when she wanted him to do things in the White House, weigh in with her husband on things, and he declined to do so. The fact is, both of the Bushes got along pretty well with President Reagan. Neither of them got along very well with Nancy Reagan.
I wonder, too, you know, toward the end of her life, Mrs. Bush, what kind of sense did she have of the Bush family legacy, the contributions of, you know, her husband and her son who had been presidents and others as well? And also what, if anything, she thought about her place in that legacy?
So I can tell you she hated the word legacy because she thought it sounded kind of like you thought you were a big shot. And in fact, she hated the title of my book. The title of my book is The Matriarch. She didn't like the word matriarch. She didn't like being called a matriarch, although she was a matriarch. Barbara Bush in the Making of American Dynasty. She hated the word dynasty because, again, it sounded like something that was very entitled. So I asked her what she thought I should title my book. And she said, "The Fat Lady Sings Again."
She certainly had a sense of humor.
She did.
What in your conversations with her do you most remember? In other words, what surprised you or delighted you or amazed you the most from all the conversations you had?
Before I started the book, I knew that she was interesting, but I would not say I really knew whether I liked her, because she had been a little crisp with me when I was a reporter at the White House and she was First Lady. And I didn't exactly take offense at that, but I wasn't sure whether I liked her or not. I thought she was going to be interesting whether I liked her or not. But I can tell you, after these five interviews in the last 6 months of her life, I liked her so much. She was funny. She was incredibly candid. She had no regrets. She had a very clear-eyed view of her life and what she had done. She was proud of her children and her grandchildren, and she was proud of them not because they had become powerful or rich, although some of them had. She expressed pride in them because they had done things for other people. And I think if you talk about Barbara Bush's legacy, that may be the legacy. You look at her grandchildren. You know, the grandchildren of the rich and powerful often go astray. It can be hard to be in a family situation that when your parents and your grandparents have been very accomplished. But you look at the Bush grandchildren, and one of them left a corporate job to run Big Brothers, Big Sisters of Greater Texas. One of them helped found a global feeding program. One of them was a co-founder of the Global Health Corps. They do have a record of doing things that involve helping people other than themselves.
I mean, there were some notable confidants for President Bush, the first President Bush, James Baker, Brent Scowcroft on national security issues. How would you rank Mrs. Bush in terms of importance as a counselor, as an advisor?
Barbara Bush would not usually go to her husband and say, this is what you ought to do about health care. But she would go to him and say, AIDS is a big problem. You should try to do something more about AIDS. When it came to the negotiations to end the Cold War, which was a great part of President George H.W. Bush's legacy, she did not go to him and say, let's do this about throw weights on nuclear weapons. But what she did do was say, I can make Reza Gorbachev a friend of mine, and that will help make your negotiations easier. And she did.
Exactly. That was a fascinating part of the book. She wasn't out front in a sense like Hillary Clinton, but she was possibly equally influential. Would you say so?
Influential in different ways. Mm-hmm. You know, you think about, for instance, AIDS. When the AIDS crisis was emerging during the Reagan administration, President Reagan almost never mentioned the issue. He almost never said the word AIDS while he was president. And this was distressing to Barbara Bush, although she didn't say that publicly. But what she did do was, as soon as she was first lady, in her first 100 days as first lady, she visited Grandma's House, which is a home in Washington for infants with AIDS. It's still here. It's still run by the two women who founded it way back then. And she took photographers with her. She didn't make a big speech, but she had her picture taken holding a baby with AIDS, Donovan, just 6 months old. He would be dead within a few months. And just the simple fact of doing that and having her picture taken and cuddling him and holding him against her cheek and rubbing his back sent this enormously powerful message to the whole world.
Speaking of that, I remember that distinctly, and I think that sent an important message, very symbolic, a simple gesture like that. And probably the death of her daughter had something to do with that, her sympathy, her empathy.
And her understanding about how the stigma about AIDS was hurting human beings. You know, she told me that when Robin went to Sloan Kettering, a famous cancer hospital in New York, for treatment, and it was clear that she wasn't going to survive. And they took Robin back to Texas for one last visit so that she could see her two big brothers, George W. and Jeb Bush, so that she could see her neighbors and friends before she passed away. And Barbara Bush told me, with tears in her eyes, that some of her best friends refused to visit because they were afraid that you could catch leukemia, which you cannot. And she saw people with AIDS facing similar circumstances, and that is one reason I think she felt so deeply about what was happening to them.
It seems like from the portrait, she could be an intense person, especially behind the scenes. I wonder in an instant how she was able to cope with the 1992 loss of her husband in the reelection bid to Bill Clinton. But then we have a later chapter about Bill Clinton, who's almost seen as an honorary Bush sibling because of how he gets close to the family, particularly the man he defeated. And I wondered what she thought of Bill Clinton and that sort of evolution on all of that.
What a turnaround that was, right? In 1992, Bill Clinton defeated George Bush for re-election. Both Bushes, George Bush and Barbara Bush, felt that he had been defeated by a lesser man, that they had questions about how honorable Bill Clinton was. And so there was hard feeling about that campaign for some time. But as you say, George Bush and Bill Clinton began to do a project together at the request of George W. Bush to raise money for tsunami victims. That was the beginning of what amounted to a beautiful friendship. Bill Clinton was very deferential to George Bush, which George Bush appreciated. And Bill Clinton, as you know, is a very loquacious, funny, talkative guy. He's engaging. And the two men became friends. Barbara Bush was a lot harder to win over. I interviewed Bill Clinton for this book, and he acknowledged that it took a lot longer to win over Barbara than it did to win over her husband. But eventually she saw the relationship that her husband had with Bill Clinton. She knew it meant a lot to him, and so therefore it was okay with her. And it was her children who started to call Bill Clinton their brother from another mother. Although I would note that under that construct, she would be Bill Clinton's stepmother, not his mother.
And interestingly, in the book, you said that Bill Clinton said that George would not have become president without Barbara. So while she maybe had some skeptical view of him initially, he certainly acknowledged her strength and her contribution.
Bill Clinton had a very, I think, perceptive insights into the strengths of Barbara Bush and also the way in which Barbara Bush had made her life accommodate George Bush's ambitions.
Susan, look, you've covered so many presidents, and you've seen the Republican Party and the Democratic Party as they've evolved. Speaking of the Republican Party, Nixon to Reagan to Bush 41, 43, and now, of course, Trump. How surprised or dismayed are you about the apparent abdication of the bedrock principles of the Republican Party? Free trade, you know, aversion to deficit spending, the U.S. role in the world, you know, standing by democracies and our allies. These have been traditional underpinnings of the party. And we're seeing that go by the wayside under Trump.
I wouldn't say I'm dismayed. I'm a reporter. I cover things. I'm not a commentator making judgments about them. But I will say that the Republican Party has changed in some fundamental way since 2016. On some of the issues that used to be the pillars of the Republican Party used to be a strong military, free trade, concern about budget deficits. And these are not the characteristics. These aren't the founding principles of the Republican Party, which has now, I think, been largely defined by President Trump. This is President Trump's Republican Party. It's got a much more populist tone. It's much more skeptical of free trade. It is less likely to project American power around the world. It sees a different role for the United States, not so much as the leader of the world in terms of keeping military troops in places like Germany and South Korea, or asserting itself as a leader when there are pro-democracy demonstrations in Hong Kong. It sees a different role for the United States. And so this party has changed. Parties do change, though. The Democratic Party has changed as well, even just since President Obama left office. We see that with the campaign that is now underway. It is a more liberal Democratic Party. And it's a Democratic Party that has more open skepticism about some aspects of capitalism. So both parties, I think, in the midst of some big changes.
Well, back to the Republican Party, though, circling back to Barbara Bush, she certainly made no secret of her dismay with the direction of the Republican Party under Trump.
The first time I interviewed Barbara Bush for this book, I asked her, President Trump is president, are you still a Republican? And she said, yes, I'm still a Republican. The last time I interviewed her, which was 5 months later, I said, you know, the first time I interviewed you for this book, I said, are you a Republican? And you said, yes, do you still feel that way? And she said, no, I think now I'd have to say I'm not a Republican. Now, that doesn't mean she was a Democrat. It meant she felt she didn't have a party. And in that way, she was speaking for, I think, a lot of more moderate traditional Republicans when they look at the political scene in the United States now.
And Trump's rise, to a degree, he wasn't just attacking Obama. He often would go after George W. Bush, his policies on the economy, on the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I had to wonder that that must not have sat very well with her in terms of trying to use them as a punching bag, in a sense, in his campaign.
And of course, he was fiercely critical of Jeb Bush, who was running against him for the nomination, called him low-energy Jeb. She didn't like that a bit.
That is very true. He has nicknames for many people. Well, back to Barbara once again as we close, Susan. What about her relationship with what we would call today the feminists? You convey in The Matriarch that she had somewhat of an ambivalent view of the feminist movement, because instead of pursuing a career, she chose to stay home with her children, focus on her husband's career. And she seemed okay with that. But over time, it looked like she felt a little bit, you know, heard, or that she internalized this message of that the women's movement, you know, was basically favoring women who chose careers.
You know, she had, I think, no regrets about the course of her life. And of course, she had had a very interesting life with influence that extended well beyond the children she stayed home to raise. She did have some resentments toward the women's movement, because I think she felt that, especially in the early days of the women's movement, that it dissed women like her, that it didn't respect the contributions that they were making. That was one of the factors that contributed to a spate of depression that she had in the 1970s. In my view, she was a feminist. In my view, she walked the walk of feminism. She was confident and outspoken. She did things. She was active. She asserted herself. But she didn't talk the talk of feminist. And at one interview, I tried to make her say she was a feminist because she seemed like a feminist to me. And we went around and around and around, and I finally gave up.
Like you said, more important was that she walked the walk.
She did do that. And she was very proud of her granddaughters and very accepting of the idea that even the ones who had young children were choosing to work outside the home, making a choice different than the choice she had made.
The book is The Matriarch, Barbara Bush and the Making of an American Dynasty. The author, Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. Susan, congratulations once again on this very moving book, and thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Press Conference USA on The Voice of America was produced in Washington. Joining me on the program was VOA Senior National Correspondent Jim Malone. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.
This is VOA.